You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2017 on Monocle 24.
Live from Studio One in London, this is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
I'm afraid the bad news is there has been a spike in hate crime, including in particular Islamophobic crime, after the London Bridge attack. We've got to make sure that the community has confidence to report these things to the police and to the authorities. But also, I reinforce the message from the Commissioner. The police will take a zero-tolerance attitude towards this.
After a violent few weeks, can London maintain its status as a tolerant and accepting city? We'll also look at how the death of an American student detained in North Korea might affect the world's response to rising tensions. Plus,
I wish we had some video or some audio from this briefing to share with you, but the White House...
Yet another report out tonight paints the picture of a president who feels under siege.
What's fascinating here is he is the guy they've put forward to be the main flag catcher on this case, because as you said earlier, they can't find anyone else who wants to do it.
As chaos engulfs the White House, why has the president's press secretary gone suddenly camera shy? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Daniela Pellard, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and James Boyes, political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world. Welcome both to the programme. Now, London has long been known as one of the most diverse cities in Europe. About 37% of its citizens were born outside of the United Kingdom. But Monday's van attack outside a mosque in London's north has left many fearful of a racial backlash that may yet get worse. Daniela, do you think we are genuinely in the midst of a landscape that will be permanently changed, and that we are that divided? Because when I look at these events, I think they are terrible and terrifying, and the communities targeted must feel a sense of panic. But I don't know if this one guy driving up from Cardiff really says that much about our city. In a way, I kind of feel that even today, when you go out, the city's not a place of terror and fear. There's a piece in the New York Times today saying there's an unease in London.
There's not an unease in London.
And I don't see it in the people standing outside the pub at the end of the day. Terribly, life carries on after all of these attacks.
I don't see it at all. I've been to many of the places that, or near the places that have been attacked recently, a week later, a few days later, and really life is carrying on as before. I mean, it's also been very hot, and this sends British people crazy. Everyone has been out enjoying the sun. We're not reeling or anything. And while I think this idea that, oh, we're all standing together in the Blitz spirit can be overstated, there is a lot of truth to it. We need to be careful now, because this latest attack might set us on a different trajectory. But the feeling right now across the nation, the sequence of terror attacks and the Grenfell fire as well, has really pushed this idea of solidarity and unity. And that's, I think, providing a lot of comfort to people in the response. People feel that communities are being attacked, or the community is being attacked. And it's also interesting to note the government's response to yesterday's terror attack, because the first pictures that we saw of Theresa May responding to it, and we all know how badly she responded to the Grenfell fire, was within a few hours. She held a meeting within Finsbury Park Mosque with the local imams, with rabbis, with Christian leaders. It was an interfaith meeting, and she was pictured there having talks. I spoke to one of the rabbis who was in the talk. He said that it seemed very serious, and there was a very constructive discussion. But the idea and the message was of interfaith, of cross-communal cooperation. I think the government is trying to emphasise that, and the communities really have come together. I mean, there have been interfaith vigils, and it's not happy clappy necessarily. I think these things are very important in the wake of such a divisive attack.
James, I don't want to paint it too far the other way. There's definitely, I felt it myself after the London Bridge attack, a sense of anger that someone would do this in your city. And you did feel a sense of revulsion, not quite fear, but there was definitely a feeling of anger. And we know that there have been some 120 attacks, Islamophobic attacks, since those events, where people attempting to get some kind of revenge, it seems, in a twisted, mad way. But what's your take on where we stand today?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We're sitting around this table. I don't think we're necessarily particularly representative of the demographic makeup of the city we're in at this point necessarily. We're all very, very pale, I think. And I don't know how we can necessarily speak for some of the societies who are under attack. But I would certainly echo a lot of what it was that Daniela was saying with regards to, you know, there has been, I think, a knee-jerk reaction, especially from the overseas press. You're talking about the American press, and you used that word reeling, and the New York Times, I think, suggested that, you know, London was reeling after attack after attack after attack. And clearly, I don't think that is the case. I think there has been a degree of hyperbole involved with regard to this. And one thing you have seen, I think, is a sense of as you rightly point out, outrage across the city, in between and within communities, that this has happened. The idea that, you know, this latest attack was not conducted by a member of the London community, but rather by someone coming from outside into the city to commit it, you know, is this interesting development, I think. But I don't think we should read into it a great sense of development or of the sort of, you know, attempt to get some sort of vigilante response to the previous attacks, which of course had been blamed upon the Islamic community.
Daniela.
Well, I think the important thing to do now, and I say this as actually, I think somebody who is quite representative of multicultural in London. I'm a first generation British citizen. My parents are immigrants, and I am a member of a minority that's been experiencing increasing levels of hate crimes. As I'm Jewish, you know, anti-Semitism has been a real problem over the last couple of years. But I think something that the Jewish community can feed in here is the experience that we've had in monitoring anti-Semitism and combating it as well, and building up very close relationship with the police. With the point now that a Jewish person experiencing an anti-Semitic attack, I don't think would think twice about reporting it to the police, whereas somebody who's a victim of Islamophobia, I think, would think twice or three times because they wouldn't be sure that their concerns would be taken seriously. We also have very close monitoring links with other groups. You know, the infrastructure is there and it's been built up over decades. And so in a time of need, it's there. You know, as soon as a terror attack happens anywhere in the UK, there's a police liaison with Jewish communities because the synagogues and Jewish schools are seen as a soft target. Now, those kind of links have to be built up with the Muslim community. And there hasn't been enough efforts to combat Islamophobia. And it's a sensitive subject, and there are issues of freedom of speech, of course, and the Muslim community is perhaps a younger immigrant community than the Jewish community. But this hasn't been taken seriously enough. And there was an awful lot of anger at Finsbury Park yesterday about how vulnerable they are as a community, the lack of resources being dedicated to protecting places with large Muslim communities and places of worship, and also the way that, you know, sometimes justifiably, the way the media was reporting the attack. Now, it's a responsibility of all communities to deal with that, because that's not that's certainly not going to be going away.
James, there's an interesting kind of collision of storm events and all sorts of things coalescing here. So we had the Grenfell fire, where actually the issue of faith came up quite prominently because we're in the middle of Ramadan, and many of the people returning from their services were going back to Grenfell fire. They were awake, so they woke people. They've been cast as, you know, correctly as often heroes of the hour. The communities, the Muslim community centres, were very good at responding, whereas the local council failed. We have a general election in which, you know, it's been clear migration has been played into it. All these storm fronts coming together, it's quite hard actually when you think about all these things. But on the other side, if we get through this, as we get through this, I wonder if there has actually been, through all of these events, a kind of a shaking up of Britain that's quite good. That, you know, you say we're not that representative, and you know, and you're correct, you know, I have a reasonably middle class life living here in London, but we don't always get to see what other people's communities are like. And actually, through the Grenfell fire, through all of these attacks, in good and bad, we've been woken up to see who we live amongst. And I wonder whether there'll be something quite fundamentally good that comes out of this at the end. Because even in a place like Kensington and Chelsea, this you know, these wealthy neighbourhoods, people are saying, actually, I didn't know it was like that, and this is wrong.
It's possible. Again, you know, you could add to that, since we're talking about Kensington and Chelsea, you know, the election result there, of course, which I don't think many people expected that to go Labour, quite frankly, and one of the least likely locations to go Labour, you'd have thought, in the country. It's possible. You know, again, we've got to be careful, I think, that we don't read too much into short-termism, because, of course, you know, what you would hope to happen is exactly what you've just described, and the idea that we are going to sort of come together and coalesce and recognise, I think, the mass differences amongst us, etc., etc. I do think that generally, I think we are quite a tolerant city, to be quite honest. I think an awful lot of what Sadiq Khan, the mayor, has come out with has been particularly spot on in terms of discussing the city, discussing the racial makeup of the country and the city, and the different backgrounds that bring the city together. And I think he has been someone who's emerged from this very, very well, it must be said, I think. And, you know, as someone who's not necessarily always inclined to be supporting Labour, to be honest, I think he's done a sterling job. And, you know, I think that you know, when you contrast that with perhaps some of the response of our own government, the response of someone like Donald Trump, for example, I think certainly the mayor has come out of this with flying colours, and, you know, talks about the city in a way which I think is representative of how the city is and wants to be in the 21st century.
Daniel, can I ask you another question? You talked about, you know, Theresa May has obviously had a disastrous few weeks. She does seem to be on the front foot with this, and she came out very quickly to say this was an act of terrorism. Now, we're beginning to see stories today. This guy potentially has mental health problems, was living in a tent, was a local drunk. Now, that doesn't mean that he's not a terrorist, but do you think that we, I don't want to say PC, but because we want to be shown to be responding in the right way, that you can't have a debate. I think that actually someone's intention is to cause terrorism. But do you think she was a little bit too quick to label this before we had many facts?
No, I think he was a terrorist, but I mean, there are different forms of terrorists. The Westminster attacker also didn't have any real links to extremist groups. You know, he was a guy that seemed to have domestic troubles. It wasn't part of a wider plot. And the same thing goes for this guy. I mean, there is no organised right-wing terrorist network in the UK. The terrorist threat is of a different nature, but it's there. I mean, if you look at Prevent, which is supposed to identify and halt extremism, a good quarter of the referrals are for right-wing extremism, not Islamist extremism, and numbers are rising. I mean, in some parts of the country, the majority are for right-wing extremism. So it's not a question of people plotting together to carry out a mass attack, but it's still a form of terrorism, and it's still a form of radicalization.
Yeah, I just to build on that, you know, the book I'm working on at the moment is a history of US counterterrorism in the 1990s, and one of the interesting things about that, which brings it right back to this very conversation, is, you know, the debate about what is a terrorist and what is terrorism is something which has confounded policymakers, historians and politicians for millennia, quite frankly. So the idea that there is an ongoing debate about whether this guy is quote-unquote a terrorist shouldn't surprise us, because, you know, that's very much part of a historical narrative, I think.
And it's interesting we've adopted the language, and maybe the last one is Daniel, because we have spent a lot of time on this topic. But what's interesting is, you know, whenever we see an attack by a Muslim person, there's always this debate, why didn't the community do more? Why didn't the community report them? Someone in the community must have known. So we've already seen today that this guy was down the pub the night before saying, I intend to kill Muslims. He was a known troublemaker. He was a difficult character. No one phoned the police. No one said, okay, let's get him arrested tonight. And actually today, the stories about his family and his friends are ones of empathy. They're like, the poor wife, the poor ex-partner, whatever, who's had to put up with this man, and what a terrible thing to happen to her. Whereas if this was, you see, so I think we've adopted the language in some places, but actually when it trickles through to the media, we're not saying the same things as if this was a Muslim attack.
Well, I think it's striking as well, since the London Bridge attackers were reported by community members and they were highlighted and there seem some failures there. But you're right. I think the media, the mainstream media, often gets a really hard time undeservedly from, especially in the run-up to the election and over issues of reporting terror. But we should be very careful about that.
I want to move on to a seemingly completely disconnected story, but it kind of has a bit of a trail here, because we've seen here, you know, the terrible repercussions of people thinking they're getting revenge, or they're thinking they're settling at some score, whether they Islamists or whether they are, you know, white guys driving up from Cardiff. But there was also this yesterday, the announcement that the 22-year-old American student Otto Warmbier had died. Now, he'd been a prisoner in North Korea, and he was repatriated in a coma last week after 17 months in prison. Donald Trump said that his administration is equipped to handle the brutal North Korean regime. Senator John McCain said that Warmbier's death was murder, hostile action that the US should not tolerate. Now, we can all kind of imagine awful scenarios here, but my kind of feeling was, you know, hearing his parents, first of all, they were, I think they are very Christian, and they were saying, you know, we want to value the time we have with him, and that's the thing we want to think about at the moment. But there must be an instinct for revenge here, and actually at a state level. Do you think, well, we'll start with you, James, you know, is it right, actually, that there is, in these instances, you know, a real plain revenge for this?
Well, I think at the state level, at a bureaucratic state level, there won't be. That's not how, you know, the State Department works at an instinctive bureaucratic level. Where it might come is in the mindset of someone like Donald Trump, who's not, you know, a trained professional politician, who's not a diplomat, who's got no experience in the sort of the remit that he is now involved in. He has talked, as you rightly point out, in rather stark terms with regard to, we can handle this, it's all very black and white. Now, what that can possibly lead to is debatable. We have seen in the last couple of days and weeks an interesting development from the White House in terms of pushing military decisions away from the center to the Pentagon. He's clearly talked in rather bellicose terms with regards to North Korea. It's interesting to contemplate what would have happened if this poor chap had died in North Korea. And it's interesting then telling that the authorities there released him quite unexpectedly. Nobody knew, as I understand it, certainly it wasn't released, that he was in a coma until he was on his way back. And then he's died very, very subsequently shortly thereafter. You know, whether that was an attempt, you know, knowing that he was in a very, very bad state, to get him out of the country so that he didn't die in captivity, so that they could say, well, he was in the US, etc., etc., something of a fig leaf upon the situation, is perhaps unknown at this point. But there's no doubt, I think, that you know, the stakes are already very, very high with regards to the United States and North Korea. The US has sent battle carrier groups to the area and has clearly made some very, very bellicose noises with regards to the missile tests that are engaged over there. So, you know, the stakes are rising. And when you consider how much attention is being paid to the ongoing discussions in Washington, D.C., with regards to Russia, for example, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that, you know, this could very well become a very dangerous situation very, very quickly.
Daniela, you know, it's complicated even further by the fact that there are three U.S. passport holders, Korean Americans, also in captivity at the time, who we believe are still alive and not in the vegetative state that Otto Warmbier was left in. But again, I come back to this central question. You know, it's such a terrible thing to have happened. It's a crime, and it's a crime that, you know, goes not just against one family, but, you know, is an attack on a nation. And all the ideas of, you know, diplomacy and niceness, surely they are kind of out the window at this point. Isn't it there a kind of justification almost for some kind of revenge in these situations? It shouldn't be, you know, just accepted as the order of the day.
Well, I think it also, it matters how much the nation perceives that its prestige or its honour or its reputation has been damaged. And I agree, had he died while in North Korea, that might have changed the landscape a little bit. I mean, a previous example might be when the Jordanian pilot was killed in a really brutal way by Islamic State, set on fire in a cage and broadcast to millions. And that spurred a very strong response, a personal statement from the king, and military action. And I think that had the support of the people. But that was a much more regional and a much more high profile and a much more militaristic situation. Look, the stakes are so high with any confrontation with North Korea that even Donald Trump would think twice before even getting into the game.
Well, you're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellet and James Boyes. Coming up next, we're going to look at the US as it asks Israel to loosen the reins on the Palestinian economy.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You're back with Midori House, and still with me are James Boyes and Daniela Pellet. The United States' approach to the delicate situation between Israel and Palestine is facing renewed angst, with calls for Israel to ease its controls on the Palestinian economy. Well, Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will meet both Israeli and Palestinian leaders this week. But there's already a clear reluctance to deliver many of the measures requested by the Trump administration. And the measures that have been agreed upon were already in place under the previous Obama administration. Maybe we should start with you, Daniela. Any hope of any progress here? You know, because you know Donald Trump obviously feels that he has the ear of Netanyahu, and you would imagine
not just the ear, probably.
Yeah, yes, was feeling that he was going to get his way. This was one, at least one person who understood him and would do his bidding. But it doesn't seem that actually the Netanyahu government is going to go along with it.
Well, I mean, it's not quite as straightforward as people and Israel's right wing had hoped, because Trump's lack of policy and lack of predictability has been a bit of an issue when it comes down to Israel-Palestine as well. Although relations are still extremely warm and extremely cordial, and I'm afraid I don't buy this whole objections to economic concessions to the Palestinians. I think this is just posturing ahead of the concessions that will be made, and perhaps partly Netanyahu's people briefing to sort of derail the much more right-wing members of his opposition, and his government, who are always calling for action and tough lines. Because really, Netanyahu is one of Netanyahu's solutions to the whole issue has been to bolster the Palestinian economy. Even parties to the right of him, like Habayit HaYehudi, led by Naftali Bennett, see a solution as give the Palestinians jobs, boost their economy, and somehow magically they will forget about their nationalistic aspirations. So I don't think that is the real issue here. When it comes to real concessions, I mean, it's hard to think because there is no roadmap in any sense. I mean, the last roadmap got torn up, I don't know how many years ago. So I think we'll What would be interesting just to see if Jared Kushner can get through this this whole visit without some sort of awful foot-in-mouth episode.
James, your views of Jared Kushner, the peacemaker?
Oh, the real estate dealer who's going to go to the Middle East and become the Henry Kissinger of his generation. It's remarkable, isn't it? I think, you know, just flip this around. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, And her solution to the Middle East was, I'm going to send Chelsea over there to get these two people together. You know, we'd be sitting there going, this is ludicrous, and rightly so. You know, this idea that this guy whose only qualification is being married to the president's daughter is going to come over to the Middle East, bang some heads together, and, you know, all of a sudden we've got everybody living together. It's just farcical. And you've got to wonder, you know, what on earth is going on in the minds of some of these people? And again, if... It's great that Netanyahu and Donald Trump clearly get on so well. I mean, you saw the bonhomie between the two men when the president visited Israel recently. But, you know, that is not, you know, the be-all and end-all. You know, Netanyahu leads, you know, a coalition government, right? And he's got to keep, you know, all elements of that together. And it's not enough that the two men get on. And ultimately, this is going to come down to, you know, what it always does, which is Israeli national interest. And they will do what's in their national interest. And that might well not be what it is the United States wants. You know, they've got their own national interest to deal with. And it is not for Jared Kushner to come along and say what that might be. You know, it's a very, very difficult situation, put it mildly, quite frankly. And, you know, and obviously Daniel's brilliantly placed to talk about this. But, you know, the idea that we're going to get some sort of magical solution when there is no solution on the table, it seems at this point, you know, is fanciful, quite frankly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, one major issue is that the Israelis can't agree what is in their own national interest. I mean, both, I don't think Palestinians either. So there isn't even it's not a case that an American president or leadership is going to come and give them some nudges on in the right direction. There isn't a direction. You know, I see stalemate for another generation or so. But at least, you know, let's look on the bright side. No, people have such low expectations of Jared Kushner's visit that, you know, they say it's the hope that kills you. That's not going to be the case here.
Well, you probably won't hear about it at the White House press briefing anyway, because Sean Spicer seems to have slightly vanished, well, apart from his appearances played by somebody else on Saturday Night Live. But that's partly why the White House, though, has taken to banning the live broadcast of its briefings. And the overall flow of official information from the White House has also taken a bit of a hit. Spicer and his deputy, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, have briefed reporters just 7 times this month. James, why is he so keen to kind of go into the wings all of a sudden?
It must be pointed out, before I answer that directly, that Sean Spicer is scheduled to give an on-camera press briefing today at the White House. But certainly in the last day or two, they have had press conferences, yesterday in particular, that was off-camera, no reporting, no audio allowed of that, which was remarkable, quite frankly, considering that this administration came to power promising to basically be much more open and transparent. There's no doubt, I think, that President Trump has been horrified by how Spicer's press conferences have gone. He's extremely thin-skinned, and the Saturday Night Live scoops that you were rightly talking about, I think, has...
So you think he's properly offended? They upset him, you think?
I think the idea that you've got Sean Spicer being played
by Melissa McCarthy.
By Melissa McCarthy in such a spot-on caricature, effectively. You know, you add that, you know, the idea that Steve Bannon's being portrayed as death, effectively, and that Donald Trump is the kid who isn't really the president, I think has got to him. And the suggestion is that Spicer is going to get kicked upstairs to be potentially White House communications director. They're interviewing, apparently, people from Fox News to come in, and potentially, you know, Lisa Ingram, I think, was someone who was basically being shortlisted to come along and be a replacement. You know, there will be, I think, a new face at the podium within the coming weeks, and Sean Spicer, I think, will move upstairs. But they've been having so many press conferences, a daily press conference that's going live at 1 o'clock, I guess, every afternoon. That is quite unusual, I think. And I think stepping back from that wouldn't do the White House any harm, because clearly they're doing themselves so much damage, especially when you've got completely contradictions between the White House press conference press spokesman, the president, and the president's lawyer, and all the questions about Russia, which is what everybody wants to get asked, and now being referred to the lawyers. So the press guys, whether it's Spicer or anybody else, can't actually answer the questions that everybody wants to ask.
Well, Daniela, I'm not going to let you answer any questions either, because I'm afraid that's actually all we have time for on today's show. On a very hot, hot day here in London, There's quite a few pairs of shorts, I must admit, in this studio. That brings us to the end of the show with James Boyes and Daniela Pellet, and thank you very much to both of them for joining us at a very hot Midori house. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco and also by Fiametta Sasana. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next, then at 1900 hours, it's our design show, Section D. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, have a great day and goodbye.